The Sustainable Hour.
For green, clean, sustainable Geelong. The Sustainable Hour.
And here at the Sustainable Hour, we would like to pay our respect to the traditional custodians of the land on which we are broadcasting from, the Wathaurong people, and pay our respect to their elders past and present and coming here in the future. The traditional owners of our land lived in harmony with the environment, with the land, and with the climate for hundreds of generations. And I think we, the European settlers, and I can speak for myself, the newly arrived ones, we yet have to demonstrate that we can also live in harmony for another hundreds of generations onwards. That's certainly what we talk about here in the Sustainable Hour. That's an area where we could learn something from the traditional owners of this land. And talking about the future, that means that we are extending our respect to those children, the future generations, the unborn. And there is this old saying, we don't inherit the earth from our ancestors. No, we borrow it from our children. And we will be talking today about children, about youth, because there's so many decisions being made at the moment here in Australia which are all about ignoring the youth and ignoring climate change, which we all know is going to have the worst consequences of it. It's not going to be the older generations who are going to suffer with them. That's going to be our children. We'll be talking about the youth today, but let's start somewhere else. Colin Market, welcome to the Sustainable Hour. And what do you have for us today?
Hello, Mick. I've got a couple of really interesting little things. The first one is that the Philippines, President Rodrigo Duterte, as you, is not down as one of our regular people who we would be quoting. He's the fellow who has a war on drugs, and he's allowed his police to really put on their own vigilante. But he has decided that climate change is now going to be a much larger item in his government. And in December of last year, he brought out a new scheme that he called the TRAIN, which is the Tax Reform and Acceleration and Inclusion Bill. And that has excise and taxes on imported coal, with the idea that it goes up annually each year. And that is pushing his power companies in the Philippines to reduce the amount of coal-fired power generation throughout the Philippines, and it's already working. It's September now, it's had 10 months. It is working. They are now closing down coal-fired power stations. It's Australian coal that they're burning, as a general rule, and they're switching now over to wind-powered. They don't have too many of the standard type things. They haven't got the opportunity. When you look at their geography, they haven't got the opportunity to put in things like hydro power, because they don't have too many high rivers that you can dam and create, and they don't have geothermal. So they're now looking at solar energy, and they're looking at wind power, and as such they have been shifted up into the top 20 in the world of countries that are now moving in a positive way. And another two that have come into this moving into the top 20 from outside of the top 20 are, believe it or not, China and America, both of whom are really large users, but both of whom are right now moving into more more positive areas on using sustainable energy, to the extent that both of them are going to become, without a doubt, into the top 10, despite the fact that they continue to use a lot of electricity that is creating at the moment. They're both the world's largest two creators of greenhouse gases, but at the moment they are both moving so fast in the area of replacing coal-fired, which is the CO2 producing, and putting in retrainable stuff. And the other one, the third one that's come into it, is the United Kingdom. The United Kingdom has one of the really strange people that's pushed the United Kingdom into its sustainable impetus, and that's the Queen. The Queen's properties throughout the UK are now all being shifted over to sustainable energy. And she's got large holdings in Scotland, and there are times in Scotland when all of its power is being created by wind energy. All the power that it uses as a nation, there are considerable amounts of time now where it's 100% Scotland. And much of that is thanks to the Queen. Now, if you really look at your leadership, the Queen is the leader of Australia. She's our titular head. You have to ignore the Prime Minister and his cohorts. They give no leadership at all. But our true leader, if you like, the Queen, is very much into sustainable energy. So let's take a bit from there. And I think you can also say that in America, Donald Trump, is not pro renewable energy, but America is moving that way despite him.
Mm.
It's the opposite way with China. It's being led from the top. China has said, hey, look, we're creating pollution. The main cities are very polluted. We're going to solve it.
Mm.
And that comes from the leadership at the top. A bit like Duterte. If your leaders say we're going to do it, it happens. In America and in Australia, it's happening despite our leaders.
That's right. And the good news is that we are heading for 50% renewables, regardless of what government is doing in a way,
yep,
by 2025 here in this country.
Yep.
So be aware of that.
Yep.
There you go. That's my world outlook for the day.
That's so important to have this global outlook. Thank you, Colin Mockett. And I want to continue on that thread just briefly, because Q&A, did you watch Q&A on ABC this Monday night? It's such an extraordinary program, because this is really where the nation is talking. And this was an interesting one. It was a high school special.
Mm-hmm.
So it was school students in the panel. Yep. And a lot of them in the audience as well, asking questions and so on. And then there were two politicians. And in this clip I want to play here, they're talking about bushfires and climate change. And again, they're talking about China and America, and using, this is the liberal youth member who's saying that, well, you know, America and China are so big and they're polluting so much. You know, so they're kind of using that as an excuse,
yep,
that this is the reason we should be doing it too or something.
Yeah, well, no,
you know, but
I don't really know what they're arguing is in that regard. They bring in the per capita thing, don't they? They say we don't use very much per capita.
Oh, we do. We're world leaders in that. 22 tons per
population.
Person.
Yep.
Yeah. This is Barnaby Joyce saying, therefore, we have so little influence on the global, you know, we're 1.5% of global emissions.
Yep.
But, you know, imagine if we had that same attitude with other things in life.
Oh, yeah.
You know, for instance, about how we deal with our garbage.
Yep.
You know, that because others are being pigs somewhere else, then we should just be pigs ourselves.
Yep.
Hey.
Oh, look, that's never a winning argument, is it?
No, not in a civilized world.
No.
You know, so it's actually a very uncivilized argument. Mm. But anyway, thank you very much for this global perspective, Colin Mockett. It's wonderful to kick off like that. So I want to take you into the Q&A. I just have a little clip from there. First, we hear Holly Cook. She's from a college in South Australia. Then Penny Wong, who's the opposition leader at the moment in the Senate, has a little statement. And then we hear Joanne Tran, a young liberal from a high school in Sydney. First, we hear the question from someone who has experienced the bushfires firsthand.
In March this year, we saw a bushfire tear through our town, Tarpa, fanned by extreme weather conditions. And in August, we had another out-of-control bushfire burning to the west of Tarpa. We've just seen our elected Prime Minister ousted by the conservative right, who doesn't want action on climate change. When will we finally get politicians who will act for our future and take meaningful action on climate change?
Holly, we'll start with you.
I think if any of us choose to become politicians, you'll be absolutely seeing effective policy on climate change. Personally, and I know that in my generation this is a huge thing, is that climate change is real. It's happening. Global warming is having an effect already that the extent of which humankind, I don't think, has ever seen before. This is a problem that I don't think the consequences of which we perhaps aren't fully understanding, at least in a political scene, and this is so incredibly disturbing. So in terms of effective climate policy, we need it because we're not going to have a planet Earth if we don't get one soon.
Sorry.
No, please go.
If I may. We did try. And it's one of the, I was the climate minister between 2007 and 2010, and one of the things I really tried to do was to land a bipartisan agreement with Malcolm Turnbull as the leader of the opposition. I actually got the deal. And then they removed him. And guess who took him down? Tony Abbott. It's a kind of recurring theme, isn't it? And the reason I wanted to get that agreement was I knew that I had a sense that we needed that bipartisan framework to drive the change, because it's a whole of economy reform. But leaving aside the politics of that, I've had a few hard times in politics, but one of them was at Copenhagen when we were not able to get the agreement that we needed. Now, you know, in hindsight, I think we got the Paris Agreement because Copenhagen failed, and there was a lot of work done between that conference and the UN conference where we got the Paris Agreement. But I felt this such deep sadness that that I could be in a room with Obama and Clinton and, you know, leaders across the world, and we were not able to land an agreement to try and divert the worst of the conflict.
You're saying it's not only Australia that has a problem with this policy area.
I think humanity has been irrational when it comes to climate change. Mm-hmm. Because if we really were rational, we would say, hey, is this really, you know, bad thing happening, let's try and deal with it. Yeah. But instead, we've had this argument, we've had it here in Australia, but it has been played out in other nations as well, yeah, where we have a discussion which is not connected to the facts.
Yeah. Okay, now I'm going to bring in Joanne. You're a young Liberal. Yes. How do you feel about climate change, and how do you feel about the way this issue is played with by politicians?
Mm-hmm. Climate change is a major issue facing our global community, and I feel like in order for the combat against climate change, we need to work together as a global community. And I feel like one of the best solutions to combat climate change is market-based solutions, for example, the ETS. At the same time, I feel like we...
You do remember Tony Abbott as a person who
decided yes,
that was never going to happen.
The thing is that... the two major emitters of carbon emissions is the USA and China. And as we are speaking right now, China is building coal-fired plants across the world, and the US has just pulled out of the Paris Agreement. So without these two major emitters, I feel like we can't be as effective as possible to combat climate change if we don't work together as a community.
Well, it's bad for politicians to sort of say, disagree with a younger person, is it, on television. But I don't think the fact that they're not, we wish that other nations would do more is an excuse for us to not act.
Yeah.
So this was a clip from Q&A Monday night. And I mean, there you get it. Or you understand that the youth get it. Because everyone there in that panel totally understood what climate change is about and what the problem is. Yesterday, climate change was being discussed up and down the walls in Melbourne in Northcote Town Hall, the world's first climate emergency conference, which is organized by a local government. I certainly haven't heard about any other local government talking about climate emergency. We've heard climate change mentioned all over the place, but climate emergency is a different, it's like taking it up one notch, isn't it?
Sitting councillors and mayors from around Australia, they've signed a declaration that they understand that we're in a climate emergency and that all levels of government, including councils, take action to stop the climate emergency. And this is the campaign from the climate emergency, part of the climate emergency declaration campaign. We're at CASE, Committee Action in the Climate Emergency, are working with Sedamia, and we're working on getting more and more councillors to sign up. We're here today at the Darabin Climate Emergency Conference, which is probably the first government conference on the climate emergency anywhere in the world.
And Tony is still there today, which is why he's not with us in the studio. But Tony, you are at the conference right now, is that right?
Yes, we are, Mick. We're just popped outside for a while. I've got Tiffany Harrison with me.
Hello.
And Tiffany Harrison lives in Darabin Council, and she's also works on the council. So she's kind of got she's a bridge in a lot of ways between the community and council.
I was there yesterday, and I noticed there certainly wasn't any councillors from Geelong, but there were councillors from the neighbouring councils, which is interesting, because what if this idea of talking about the climate emergency as a crisis, as an emergency, and dealing with it that way, spread from one council to the next? Do you think that is an option?
Definitely. So that's really the work that we're trying to do. So I work on the Climate Emergency Darabin Group, which is a community group that's working with council to look at how do we spread the climate emergency. So this has been a campaign that's been going on for sort of 4 or 5 years of trying to get a local government to adopt the climate emergency. And the reason why we're looking at local government is because that's the closest level to the people, and that also can interact with other levels of government and also interact with other councils. So the aim is that it spreads like wildfire, I guess, to other councils. So that's really going to be a big focus of ours over the next few years, is trying to get other councils to adopt this. Now, we've had interest from other councils like in WA, Ginston, Banyuls being interested and looking at resolutions which aren't put to full climate emergency. But any council laws that are interested in signing this, and we're really keen to talk to them, and also keen to talk to community members about strategies to try and get community groups to support councillors to undertake this, because it's really sort of the community groups and the councillors that can work hand in hand to get this happening in other areas.
So here in Geelong, I have already talked with some councillors, and I don't really sense much interest in a way, because the immediate response is, no, we don't want to talk about the emergency. It may be that it's an emergency, but we're not going to talk about it.
Yeah, and that's a challenge. I mean, we've seen in the last probably, again, 4 or 5 years, even within the climate change movement of people who've been working in climate change for so long, there's this reticence to mention the emergency and to talk about it. But I guess where I'm coming from, and where a lot of people are coming from, is the perspective of needing to tell the truth. So I've got a science background, and looking at what the science meant, I feel a personal moral responsibility to talk about how what the truth is and how it impacts people. And that's been a long time to sort of get through the narrative of how can we talk about this and the extent that it is. But I guess that there's a lot of people who are going to not be wanting to frame it like that. But the Darabin Council taking this on and to say, yes, we're going to talk about the emergency, to have events like this which are bringing people together from across or different councillors, community groups, to frame it really in this way, I think that's a really big breakthrough. And the more normalised it gets, and the faster that gets normalised, the better. And there's always going to be people who are able to take the forefront and to do this in different areas that are going to be able to show the way, but it will become normalised. And the more that the emergency actually hits in terms of impact, I think that it is, emergency services are going to start having to frame it like that, and it will become something that we can no longer ignore in that frame.
Yeah. And this was my feeling yesterday. I have to say, you know, when we begin to talk about climate change as the emergency that it really is, what it does in a way is that it brings us closer together. In that room, people really felt, you know, the strength that we are together, 350 people sitting here and talking about it. We can't deal with this one-on-one.
Yes.
We need to be together about it. And that's what the word emergency does, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. It's acknowledging the problem and then getting stuck into it. Mick, you said before about the Geelong councillors didn't seem to be enraptured by your suggestion of a climate emergency. I would put it to Tiffany, she might disagree, that that's exactly what the councillors said initially when it was first mooted in Darabin. There would have been that sort of response from some of the councillors.
Yeah, absolutely. And as I said, like the campaign, like we were looking at this sort of work and looking at Darabin as a key area that could take this on 4 or 5 years ago, but there's been a big shift in terms of the council laws themselves. 4 or 5 years ago, this wouldn't have been possible. And it's been a shift in who's been on council, but it's also been a shift in the community engagement and the work around it. It was a long, long campaign of lots of different points of exposure around what the climate emergency was, campaigns going on, getting people to sign it, getting people to go from signing it to a next level up. So there's been a lot of engagement work to get people there, and we're looking at the next wave. So it might be that Geelong is a few steps down the track in terms of other councillors taking it on and again starting to normalise it. But the more that other councillors are doing it and it is normalised, the easier it is to have that response and people really acknowledge what it actually means. It becomes a real thing. Yeah.
An election, it becomes an election issue too.
Yeah.
So I guess that's the word for us, is that we don't accept that no, and we keep working on it and keep finding models. And you know, like, it's not as if Geelong has to reinvent the wheel. There's a whole lot of material there that's been done already that will make it easier for them and others. That'll be the word for us.
Fantastic. Thank you very much from both of you. This is great news from Darebin. This is world news coming from Darebin and then via the Sustainable Hour and via our podcast out to the world. Isn't that amazing? We are at that tipping point, I think, where something really seriously is changing in the communities and now also at council, local government level. Let's take that out to 537 other or 36 other councils in this country here, Australia, and to the rest of the world just as well. Thank you for this report from Darebin.
No worries,
thank you.
And last week here we talked with Greta Thunberg in Stockholm about her school strike for the climate, which is something that I think is also going around the world, in Nepal, in Holland, in Norway, elsewhere. People, young people are saying, we're going to support Greta. And here's the news from Sweden. You know, her strike was supposed to have ended on Friday. She had been sitting in front of the Swedish parliament for 3 weeks, refusing to go to school because, as she says, you know, when the adults don't care about my future, why should I? And it's a good point. In the end, this is the interesting thing. From sitting there just all on her own, she had hundreds of young people joining her on the last day there, all sitting down, like the sit-down strike in front of the Swedish parliament. But then the next day, on Saturday, she announced something even bigger.
Yesterday was the last day, but we will go on with the school strike. Every Friday, as from now, we will sit outside the Swedish Parliament until Sweden is in line with the Paris Agreement. We urge all of you to do the same. Sit outside your parliament or local government, wherever you are, until your country is on a safe pathway to a below 2-degree warming target. Time is much shorter than we think. Failure means disaster. The changes required are enormous, and we must all contribute in every part of our daily life. Especially us in the rich countries, where no nation is doing nearly enough. The grown-ups have failed us. And since most of them, including the press and the politicians, keep ignoring the situation, we must take action into our own hands. Starting today, everyone is welcome. Everyone is needed. Please join in. Thank you.
Greta Thunberg speaking on Saturday in Stockholm, Sweden, in front of 1,000 people. And what we hear here is, you know, they kept clapping, clapping, clapping for minutes. Standing ovation to this 15-year-old girl. Is she making history? I don't know. That strike, if people are listening out there and are taking this up, it could change things. The youth is certainly beginning to come on board, and now we hear local councils just as well. There's something in the air. This is interesting. But one thing we are totally neglecting is we have invited a guest for the Sustainable Hour, as we always do. And it's time now to say welcome to Jackie Matthews from Suburban Scrap Solutions. And what a great name, Scrap Solutions. We love solutions here in the Sustainable Hour. Welcome, Jackie.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
And sorry for delaying. You've been sitting patiently and listening to all this climate news. But you know how we feel here? When something important is happening, then we have to get that out first. And this is world news as far as I... This is breaking news, certainly, that we bring from Sweden, but also from Darebin.
No, it's fabulous.
What's your response when you hear this?
Oh, it's good. It's just good to hear what's going on and be a part of it. You know, just know that we're all well, us here in this room, at least, are doing something to make a change. So it's always good to hear, other things that are happening.
And you're into solutions, and recycling and these things. Tell us just briefly about your company and what you're doing.
Okay, so our thing is recycling scrap metal. So my dad had a scrap metal business, or has a scrap metal business in Melbourne. So I've been around it all my life, and we just thought we'd bring it to Geelong. So a few years ago, we all moved down to Geelong from Melbourne, Port Arlington and Ocean Grove. And my dad was volunteering for his local football club and just picking up scrap metal from residents in the area to raise money for the football club. So back then, the price of scrap metal was a bit higher than it is now. And so he could actually donate, a significant amount, but at the same time, get the whole community involved in recycling and getting rid of their unwanted scrap metal. So fast forward about 10 years, and we were sitting down one day in his yard in Laverton and thought, why don't we give it a try in Geelong again and give the residents an opportunity to be able to recycle their scrap metal. So our service as a solution is to actually go to people's homes and go in and take the scrap metal out for them. So whether it's their dishwasher or fridge or something that's broken down, we actually go in, so they don't have to leave it on the sidewalk. We will go in and remove a washing machine from an old lady's laundry because she can't do it herself. So it just gives everybody in the community the opportunity to be able to recycle. And so that's sort of our solution, based concept of having a scrap solution.
That feels good.
Absolutely.
And very, very useful.
Yeah.
We certainly had some issues. There was an old fireplace we wanted to get rid of. But luckily someone, we put it out on eBay or somewhere and said, pick it up for free. And somebody did.
Yes. You know? And if you can reuse it, all the better. But a lot of these machines, they're old and they just need to go to scrap. And so instead of taking them to landfill or having them clog up your backyard, they can actually be recycled and turned back into something new again.
What is it with aluminium? I mean, we talk a lot about climate change in terms of emissions. And, for instance, I'm looking at all these cars that we're producing and airplanes and so on. They're all built with aluminium.
Mm.
But the thing about aluminium is that if we recycled what we already have, then that would be enough, wouldn't it?
Yeah,
there's enough
absolutely.
Aluminium out there. We don't have to mine anymore.
For sure.
If
for
we
sure.
were better at recycling.
Yeah. I picked up yesterday, I was just at a fellow's house in Lara, and he was finishing his business premises. And so he was cleaning up. So there was quite a lot of heavy scrap metal there. And he had a big plate of aluminium. And he said to me, oh, this would make thousands, millions of Coke cans.
Exactly.
And that's the thing. That's a really hard bit of metal, but yeah, recycled.
It ends up in landfill instead.
That's right.
It gets wasted.
Yeah, and we want to create that circular economies where, that bit of aluminium that I picked up yesterday then goes to be recycled and then is used to make other things, and we don't have to go into the ground to find it.
Exactly.
But there is also a significant saving in cost, and you're saving the faraway miles or the transport costs of mining it in Western Australia, shipping it across and then shipping it somewhere else and then bringing it back. And if you do, the sums are that if you recycle from the aluminium that you have here, then it is about 10 to 15% of the cost of actually mining the bauxite.
Win-win.
The thing is about scrap and waste in general, people don't really like having their hands in it.
It's not that glamorous.
No, exactly. So how do you deal with that? You were brought up, you said, on a scrap farm.
Pretty much, yeah. So, yeah, scrapyard is a scrapyard. It doesn't matter how many millions of dollars that company turns over, a scrapyard is a scrapyard. So it is dirty. So I guess, yeah, for me, it doesn't bother me. But I can see where it does. And so this is where, our solution in that, in people's homes, we'll go in and remove the scrap for them. They don't have to do all that digging around and going through the dirt. So it does offer a solution. A lot of people they're happy to just grab it out themselves, and even some people will help me to load the trailer, but it is a Not such a glamorous.
No. Exactly. So, but it is a solution also in terms of when we talked, which we have done now already a lot about climate change, you know, and people are asking, you know, individually, collectively, what can we do?
Mm.
This is the big question, isn't it? And this argument that it doesn't matter what I do individually. This is too big. It's got to be government solutions. This is the reason for a lot of people getting into apathy. It was actually discussed here on the Pulse last week in this interfaith program that is on Thursdays. And I just want to play a little clip where we hear Lou Baker talking about this apathy that we have when it comes to what can I do myself.
Mm.
The whole focus of, sadly, politicians and corporations is short-term economic benefit, whether it be winning our next election and therefore keeping my job, or whether it's building the bottom line and increasing the bottom line year after year.
Yeah.
There are consequences to that,
yeah.
And those consequences have led to the depletion of the resources and pollution and so forth. And I think how that's been allowed to happen is the individual has said, oh, this is all too big for me. I can't change anything. I can't do anything. So I'll just ignore it and hope that technology comes up with a solution and absolves me from my sin of apathy.
The Sustainable Hour.
For green, clean, sustainable Geelong. The Sustainable Hour.
As they talked about in the interfaith program last week, they are actually organizing a great event with this key question, individually and collectively, what can we do? Put up on the poster even. An event that's coming here on the 11th of October called Care for Our Common Home. And that's a forum where there'll be speakers, there'll be the youth perspective, there'll be secondary school children, also I think even primary school children, and there'll be artists performing and so on. So bringing all that together as a forum, discussing that thing in a Q&A style on the 11th of October in Geelong West Town Hall. We'll be talking, I think, quite a bit more about that event, because I see that as an opportunity really for the community to say, okay, we are at that tipping point, we can get together. There's room for 400 people in that room, so let's get 400 people in there, honestly, and start that discussion and find out what the solutions are. And in that, when we talk about solutions, it's great to see that more and more musicians, more and more artists are stepping into the space and saying, hey, we can contribute too here. We have something to say. Just last week, it was announced from Tim Hollow, he's the head of Green Music Australia, that he has created a song together with his band. It's called Wish, and it's about living in a climate-changed world. And on the phone we have Tim Hollow. Welcome to the Sustainable Hour, Tim.
Thanks for having me.
So, you creating a song, what's the idea?
So, yeah, it's interesting that you talk about more and more artists engaging with this issue. I found, obviously, you know, I set up Green Music Australia, as you said, and I've been campaigning on climate change and being a musician for many, many years now. But this was the first time I've actually managed to write a song about it. And it's really, it's remarkably hard, I think, to write music about issues until something comes along and triggers you. And that's what happened for me. With Foreplay, we were down at a writer's retreat in Bundanon on the New South Wales south coast. Gorgeous spot, right on the Shoalhaven River. And we were supposed to be writing for a few days and then having a gig at the end of it on the Sunday afternoon. And on the Saturday, it started raining, and it was raining really, really hard and started flooding up and down the coast. So the organisers called us the night before to say, we're a little bit worried about people getting in and out for the concert, so we might cancel the concert. And we thought, okay, well, that's fine. We'll just have more time to write. But what none of us thought is that if the audience couldn't get in and out safely, we couldn't actually get out at all. And the river rose 3 metres overnight, and we were trapped. And while that was kind of, we were perfectly safe, it was quite confronting. And my daughter, who wasn't with us at the time, she was back home. She kept calling me to make sure that we were okay, and she was increasingly worried. And at one point in the conversation, she said to me, I wish that I'd been born before climate change happened. And that hit me in the guts like nothing else before. Just acknowledging that, realizing, you know, having something said to me by my own daughter about this issue in those terms. And so I kind of, you know, we sat and we talked for a little while over the phone, you know, discussing how you can't just wish away the world as we've been given. We actually have to do what we can in that world. We have to do what we can to improve it and walk on in that world in the best way we can. And that night, this song just came pouring out of me. So, you know, it's those very personal triggers which often actually open the space up to write music about issues.
And this is a very important, when we talk about art, it's got to come from the heart. You can't, it's not like a job where you say, somebody's ordered me to do something, or it would be good for the common good if I wrote something. It doesn't work right that way, does it, for an artist?
It really doesn't. I mean, I think you can kind of direct and guide the creative process, but most of the time you've got to create the space for it. Basically, you've got to create the moment, and that was just the moment for me.
What a great story, Tim Hollow. Thanks for sharing that one with us. We're rushing on here in the Sustainable Hour. We have so much to talk about today. In particular, the climate emergency is up there because of the talk in Darwin. As we speak, they're sitting and having the world's first climate emergency conference there. But thank you, Tim Hollow. We'll come back to you and talk more about the other work that you're doing, apart from being a musician in Green Music Australia. We need a lot more musicians to, you know, catch that drift, because musicians, they have the respect, you know, contrary to journalists and contrary to politicians, people actually respect what a musician is saying because it's genuine. It comes from the heart.
Absolutely.
Usually what's being said there. This is so important.
Hugely culturally influential. Music kind of can really shape a lot of the things that we understand the world to be and our place in it. So it's a really powerful thing to do.
Thank you, Tim Hollow. And here's your song with the Foreplay string quartet. It's called Wish.
Sky, storm.
there's something called Climate KISS. And KISS, K-I-S-S, stands for Keep It Simple.
Sweetheart.
Sweetheart. Not something else that you would think. And with us on the phone, we have another artist, also a musician, and we'll be playing one more song because of that, Heidi Edmonds. You wrote a letter to the kids, starting saying, "Dear kids, I'm an adult working to protect your safe, livable planet, and I just want to say hello." And then what are you saying in the letter?
Well, for my focus, I've got my own two little girls. They're 2 and 4 years old, and so I'm obviously concerned about their future in a changing climate, and it also made me realize that other young people probably need more adults talking to them about the climate. So in my letter, I talk about, firstly, it's written for children 12 and over, and in my letter I talk about, firstly, why doesn't it seem like the adults are paying attention? And I then go on to talk about different ways that young people can get involved in climate action. But the main focus is on the fact that climate is, the way to talk about it is that it's simple, serious, and solvable, but that it's urgent.
That's interesting. Simple, serious, what was it? And solvable.
Yeah, simple, serious, solvable, and urgent.
Being a mum, Heidi, it's Jackie here from Scrap Solutions. Being a mum of 5 kids, after I looked at your website this morning, and I thought it was great. I brought up the topic with my 14-year-old son, who was sitting there slumped at the table, as he usually is before school, and I just asked him, "What do you know about, climate change? What's your perception?" And he said, "I don't know." But then he actually went on and told me exactly what it was. And I said, "Well, how do you know that?" He said, "Well, I'm not an idiot, Mum." And I said, "Yeah, but how do you know? Like, who taught you that? How do you, you know?" And so it's just, and then later I asked my 19-year-old daughter on the phone, and she was the same. She said, "I don't know how I know it, but I just know it." But then I have another 2 little girls who are 4 and 6, and I really liked what you said in your website, in that, you've got to sort of be selective of what you teach them, because you don't want to frighten them and give them that scare factor, but you just want them to be aware.
Yeah, so I wrote, so as well as the article for children on my page on climatekiss.com, there's also, as well as that article for children, there's also an article for parents, and also children that have younger siblings, to talk about how do we talk to young people about climate and environment. And I've pulled a table together within that, and basically for really young children, they're little, they don't really need to be talking about climate. They can just be talking about the environment and caring for nature and caring for the creatures, maybe not sending plastic out into the rivers and the creeks. They can cope with that even from a very young age.
Yep.
And then at about age 8, they can comprehend climate, but present it in a simple way. But then once they hit age 12, they can really start grappling with some of those bigger issues about the need to protect their future.
Yeah, fabulous. I think that's so informative for parents, because that's half the battle, is knowing what to say and how to say it. So well done on that.
Tell us about Climate KISS.
Yeah, so I guess I started it as someone who perhaps 2 years ago wasn't aware of the climate emergency, so I've been trying to simplify climate messaging, because I just see that if I, as an environmental scientist, didn't understand the issue, maybe it's not that surprising that more people don't know. Climate is complicated, and you do need to research it a little bit to understand both the challenges and the solutions. So I've been, keep it simple, sweetheart. But as part of that, I also focus on young people as well.
Well done for doing that. And as well as being a scientist, you're also a musician, is that right?
Yeah, so I have a background in electronic music production as well. So I have written a couple of songs. One is more atmospheric and one is kind of a poppy electro song. One's one to motivate people to be superheroes and protect the world, and the other one is a bit more atmospheric, and it talks a bit about the science and the world in a way that people who understand climate will hopefully feel a sense of hope from as well. So I think, you know, climate is for everyone, so bring all of your skills. If you're a scientist or a musician, you know, use what you've got to get the message out there.
And which one of the two would you like us to play in the Sustainable Hour?
I think go for Love for Our Future. It's the short and poppy one. I think that'll go down well.
It'll go down well among the youth, certainly. So let's give that one, the pop song, a go here in the Sustainable Hour. Thank you very much. And we'll be sharing the news about Climate Kiss and everything that you do to create that sort of open up that conversation with our children and our young ones, in particular once they are above 12. We need to get that conversation up on the kitchen table.
Thank you very much. Yes, and if people would like to connect with me, climatekiss.com. Thanks very much.
Thank you to Heidi Edmonds here in the Sustainable Hour. And here is Love for Our Future.
People ask me all the time, what can I actually do to fight climate change? And it's the right question, because the problem seems so big and we seem so small that it's hard to imagine there's anything we really can do. For years, environmental groups focused on individual actions, new light bulbs, different cars. Those changes are useful. The roof of my house is covered with solar panels. I can plug my car into them. I'm glad about that. It's environmentally sound. It saves me money. But I try not to fool myself into thinking that's really how we'll solve global warming. Because by this point, with the ice caps melting, we can't make the math of climate change work one person at a time. Instead, the biggest thing an individual can do is become a little less of an individual. Join together with others to form the kind of movements that can push for changes big enough to matter. Those changes fall into three broad categories. One is to push for 100% renewable energy in every town and city. And it's a push that's really working. Diverse cities from Atlanta to San Diego, from Salt Lake to Portland, have all announced they're going to go fully renewable. In fact, when the president pulled America out of the Paris Climate Accords, he said it was because he'd been elected to govern Pittsburgh, not Paris. That afternoon, the mayor of Pittsburgh announced that his city was going 100% renewable. Second is to keep carbon in the ground. Scientists have made it clear that at least 80% of known reserves of coal and oil and gas have to stay underground if we're to have any hope of meeting the climate goals the world has agreed on. That's why we fought so hard against things like the Keystone XL and Dakota Access pipelines, or for a moratorium on new coal mines on public land. We win a lot of these fights around the world, and every time we put up a fight, we slow down the fossil fuel industry, giving the engineers another year or two to drop the price of clean energy even further. And third, we work to staunch the flow of money to the fossil fuel industry. Our biggest tool is called divestment, convincing cities, states, universities, foundations, corporations to sell the stock they hold in fossil fuel companies. This tactic, pioneered in the fight against apartheid, really works. New studies show it has focused attention on climate change and drained companies of some of the money they need for further exploration. New York City was the latest convert, divesting its $200 billion pension fund from fossil fuels and taking the total global commitment to nearly $7 trillion. These are big goals. We can only accomplish them through movements. That's why we join together, all around the country and all across the planet.
Said Bill McKibben, an American author who has talked about this for 20, 30 years or so by now, and who has become a bit of a world leader, a climate champion, certainly. And I think he's right. It is about being together. Absolutely. And that's what's happening everywhere around the world. That's what Greta, that's really what Greta's story was about. At first, she sat there alone in front of the Swedish parliament. 3 weeks later, she sat there together with thousands of other Swedes. And now she's making that call out to the rest of the world for the youth, in a way, to unite and to join her on a Friday school strike every Friday until the adults fix the problem.
Mm.
How hard can it be? We will continue this talk hour after hour after hour in the Sustainable Hour, but we should also give you the opportunity, Jackie, just to round off. You've talked about your company. You should have a last word and also tell listeners how they can get in touch with you if they have some scrap metal that they want to give to your company and how it works.
Sure. So we service the Geelong region, Golden Plains, Surf Coast and Bellarine. All they need to do is they could either call our office, which is 1300 742 940, or they can go online to our website, scrapsolutions.com.au, find us on Facebook or Instagram. Welcome to message on Facebook to you know, find out more about how much it will cost them for us to come and collect their scrap. If they've got a lot of stuff, they might want us to come and have a look. So we're quite accessible and quite willing to go out and meet the community and help them.
And we're certainly supportive of that industry in the sense that it's all about solutions.
Mm.
And it's even in the name of your company. I love that.
Yes.
That's what we're about here in the Sustainable Hour. We are about solutions. And been fantastic to hear all these solutions today, I think.
Yeah.
People and young people stepping in and saying, we can do this.
Mm,
you
absolutely.
Know, procrastination's got to be over now.
Yeah,
sure.
Part of the problem with the community is its need to an education of what they actually can recycle and can reuse and repair, etc. I am familiar with this industry, and you'd be surprised when you turn up to a place or you're talking to people at a dinner party, they have no idea what they really can recycle. So how do you get that message out there, Jackie?
Oh, yeah, for sure. So we encourage people to follow us on the social media platforms, because we like to, we're constantly posting about different things that can be recycled and how they can do that. I'm also launching very soon, going out to the community and doing some talks, so that actually speaking to businesses and the like, to actually educate people on that, right? Because you're so right, Rusty. I'll be somewhere and I'll say, you know, this is what we do. We recycle scrap metal. And they say, what do you mean? What's scrap metal? And I say, well, what about your fridge that's broken down? What are you doing with that? And they're like, oh, I didn't know you can recycle that. People really
don't know.
Mm.
And so, yeah.
Well, particularly your fridge is a very important one because of the gases that are inside, so it has to be handled correctly.
Yes. Yes.
And this was exactly also what Heidi's point was, that we need education and somehow simplifying the story so that it's not so complicated. You know, we need to have the answers to what can we do very clearly up there in front of us.
Definitely. And that's the thing, as Heidi says, if you keep it simple, sweetheart, that's what people want. They want it to be kept simple because it's the hard that makes it difficult. It's the hard that makes people not do it. And so if we can give them a solution, then they'll be more encouraged to make a difference. So definitely educating and keeping it simple.
Exactly. One thing that I think is simple is that we want to get down to zero emissions. That's maybe a hard journey, but it's actually a very simple concept. It is about that we don't pollute the air anymore.
Mm.
And actually here on the 21st of September, there's something coming that I'm a little bit excited about. There is a global zero emissions day. What are you going to be doing on zero emissions day? Are you going to go zero emissions on that day?
Yeah, why not?
It's a bit of a challenge, isn't it? In the time that we live in, can it be done even? But it's something to discuss and to, I think, making a day about that is bringing up that, you know, the thought of what it means not to be emitting any carbon emissions.
And it makes people aware. That's the thing.
Yeah.
I think the thing that we need to, and this is what I teach my children, is just to be aware, because you could say mindful, but then they're like, oh, that's just too much. But being aware makes people think about it. And so if you have a zero emissions day, it's like, you know, think back years ago when they brought in the 40-hour famine. All of a sudden people were aware there's people in the world that are starving. And so now it's like zero emissions day, people are aware that there's something going on here, we need to help.
That's right. So Zero Emissions Day is on the 21st of September. That's in a little more than a week from now. And there's so many events, we can't mention them all. On the same day, for instance, in Melbourne, there's a People Power for Climate event. And there's this Care for Our Common Home event that we talked about earlier in Geelong West Town Hall, where the Geelong Interchurch Social Justice Group is creating an event, a full evening with youth, with music, with speakers, questions and answers and so on, which relates also to the Pope's encyclical Laudato Si, this 180-page long document that came from the Pope in Rome, which tells us basically we need to get off fossil fuels. Simple as that. And he said that 3 years ago. And it's about time now. We really need to start doing it. And that also means getting up on your bicycle. That's another story we don't have time for today in the Sustainable Hour. Thank you very much, Rusty, for taking care of all the technical buttons and everything.
Mate.
And thank you to Jackie Matthews. I hope we'll see you more here in the Sustainable Hour. You're doing fantastic. This was a great opening for you today.
Thank you.
You actually did the interview with Heidi, didn't you?
I did. If she could hear me, that would have been great.
So welcome to you. If you want to be part of the crew,
sure.
You're definitely most welcome.
Thank you.
That's all we could fit in the hour, and we always end the hour, I'll tell you that, Jackie, with a little thing. We used to say, be the change, and quoting Gandhi for that slogan.
Mm.
But then we have a musician in Australia who has taken up the topic of climate change, and she has made a whole album about it recently,
right.
Missy Higgins. And she has a song, and we thought we're going to localize this be the change. And instead, we always end, and are you with me, Rusty? We're saying, be the difference. This is the news.
This is Air News Victoria edition. I'm Arthur Stevens. New solar and wind farms will pump more than 900 megawatts of energy into the state's grid following the state government's reverse auction. Premier Daniel Andrews and Energy Minister Lily D'Ambrosio yesterday announced six successful projects which are expected to deliver power to more than 646,000 homes once complete.
It is a fact that the quickest new build of energy, the cheapest new build of energy that you can get into the system is renewable energy.
New research shows more than 9 in 10 Australians are concerned about environmental sustainability, with even more concerned about plastic pollution. Despite that, only half of consumers and businesses believe they're doing their fair share to protect the planet. Paul Gracie from HP says we could all do more, especially when it comes to e-waste.
Despite e-waste being the fastest growing waste stream in Australia, HP and Planet Ark found that it's still not front of mind for many Australians. We now purchase, replace and dispose of more electronics than ever before. So it's really important that Australians have access to alternatives to avoid this waste just ending up in landfill.
This is Air News Victoria.